colloquium, but she couldn't come, as you know, because of the corona, the directives that have come because of the corona virus. So, Spandana, would you like to introduce yourself? Spandana, can you hear us?
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. We can. Please go ahead.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Spandana, and I work with the team of academic team here at MathWorks, along with Dave. And my background is in chemical engineering. I did my bachelor's from NIT Surakarta and my PhD in chemical and biomolecular engineering department at National University of Singapore. And my research was mostly based on materials, where I designed and developed new types of actuators using stimulus responsive polymers, and then remodeled its mechanical behavior and studied how the transport mechanism of the stimulus could result in the actuation behavior. And this is where I use MathLab personally for my research. So in today's talk, we'll be looking at what kind of problems can be solved using MathLab. And if you are already using MathLab and there are some newer features that you find out here about and you want to know more, you can come and talk to us.
So do you have...
On a reaction diffusion problem later on, and until then they will be taking this forward.
Sure, Spandana, thanks for the introduction. So like, I would like to know if already are you any of you having like using MATLAB in research or any kind of teaching? Can I have a hand raise? Or should I assume like all of you are new to MATLAB and Simulink? Do we have any users here? Definitely, sir. Sir is there, right?
No.
Okay. So anybody here who has been a user? But have you heard of MATLAB and Simulink? Okay, so that's good enough for us as a starting point. So in academia, it is widely used, but perhaps I can give you an overview of which are the industries that use our tools. So specifically, our tools are majorly used by the aerospace and automotive industries. So that's why you will see our office locations are around those places where these industries are there. And then we have in multiple other customers, ranging from oil and gas to medical devices, renewable energy, and all these different industries. So our, like in many cases when we go to places, people are not aware of MathWorks, but they know our tools, MATLAB and Simulink. So MATLAB is a programming environment where you can write, where you can develop algorithms, work on data analysis, different visualization, and then you can go and do different kinds of numeric computation. Apart from MATLAB, Simulink is another graphical environment where you don't need to specifically write any kind of code. So there are multiple blocks. So it's a graphical environment where you can take these blocks, connect them together, and build your build and design your simulations and run your simulations. So this interface looks somewhat like this. And apart from these two, we have a multiple add-on products. Like specifically, we have add-on products for curve fitting, different specialized tasks like robotics, computer vision, artificial intelligence. So all these add-on modules actually support whatever task that you are doing. We have something for signal processing. So all these tasks can be accommodated using this one. So let's see how one problem can be solved on MATLAB. So Spandana, who is also with us, she will be showing us the workflow for this problem. So I will connect to her. Spandana, can you hear us? Yeah, we can see your screen right now.
Okay, sure. Thank you. So since no one is familiar with MATLAB, I'd like to take a moment to introduce you to the MATLAB environment. This is how MATLAB looks like. So are you able to see my MATLAB screen? Yeah,
now it is coming.
Okay, sure. So this is how our MATLAB window looks like. Currently I'm using MATLAB 2019B and MATLAB 2020A is scheduled to release this week sometime.
when we can't see the screen yet. We can't see the screen yet. Yeah, the PPT is visible. Yeah, she will be sharing the.
I'll just stop sharing for a minute and I'll get back to sharing. Okay. Is my screen visible now?
Yeah, but it's still the presentation that is there. Yeah, sure. We can see your screen now. Good. Great. Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you very much. So this is how our MATLAB window looks like. On the top, we have a tool strip. Here you can go to tabs like home, plots, apps, and so on. So in home, you can see these two buttons, right? New script and new live script. So this is where our script. This is where our scripting is done. So if you click on new live script, I'll be opening this window where I can type my commands. And at the bottom here, you'll see something known as the command window. Command window is basically where the code will get executed as soon as you press enter. So the code is not exactly saved. So if I say, for example, type a is equal to 1, it gets executed and there's a variable a that is created and it has a value 1. This is my workspace. This is like the temporary memory. And if you want to do some basic computations, like say a is equal to 2 plus 3, you can see that you can do some basic computations like this. And this is not it. We have a lot of other very good capabilities as well. So if you want to clear the workspace variables, you can type clear all and the workspace will become empty. And on the left hand side here, we have the current folder. That means if we have already written some scripts and we have saved it, we have to navigate to the current folder before we start running our scripts. So here I've created certain files and they are available here. So let me introduce you to the newer environment of MATLAB LiveScript. So MATLAB LiveScript was launched in 2016 this is a very interactive way of programming. So LiveScript looks something like this. I'll just maximize this window for you. So this is like a rich text format environment along with a section where you can write your code as well. So typically our scripting environment was more like if you go to say new script here, you'll see this is the blank scripting environment. You write your code here and then you run this code. You'll get multiple outputs, new figure windows, and then output typically comes in the command window and so on. So it's sort of scattered here and there. So what we have done is we've introduced this new environment where you can have some text part of text to introduce what program that you're writing and what equations you're writing. And the best part about LiveScript is, especially for scientists like you all, you can use LaTeX formatting to enter your mathematical equations. In this section, you can go and insert equations in LaTeX format also. So let me show you, if you go to LiveScript, insert, and then go to equation, you can directly enter the LaTeX equation. So that's how we've written this. And also, it's a very interactive environment. We have drop-down menus. Say if you want to illustrate a certain concept and execute this section of the code, we have introduced like drop-down menus or slider and so on. So when you change parameters, you can visualize how results change. I'll give a demo of this soon. So basically, this is the LiveScript environment. Today, we'll be talking about one very interesting problem in research. This was first hypothesized by this was first attempted to solve by Alan Turing. And this problem is about how Alan Turing fundamentally questioned how natural species can take such beautiful shapes, like say for example these stripes on zebra skin or the typical like fishes have very beautiful patterns on their skin. So what Alan Turing asked was, at that time in 1952, he was the first person who asked some very important questions in developmental biology, where he tried to explain why something like stripes or some patterns in nature can form. So if you observe like an embryo, for example, it should be spherical in nature, right? But it won't keep growing spherical and won't keep growing like a big ball. So what happens is at some point the embryo should evolve into having the features of a human, like say two hands should come out and then two legs should come out, and this process is known as morphogenesis. That means the shape of a particular organism takes a form of that organism, and Alan Turing tries to explain it using two mathematical equations, which are coupled differential equations basically, and he tries to say that chemical reaction, when coupled with diffusion process, which is known as reaction diffusion problems, can give rise to these kind of very stable shapes in nature. So let me give you an example of what that is. So here you can see two morphogens, as he calls it. That means they are basically two chemical species. And what is happening here is these chemical species, they can react with each other, and also they can diffuse in the spatial medium, in the spatial environment. So here you can see two cells. Assume that these are two cells, and then the blue region is the region of bees. That is, there's a lot more concentration of B, and the yellow region is the region of A, and A can get converted into B through a reaction, and which is governed by the chemical kinetics of that reaction. And also these two cells can move, like the blue circles here can diffuse into the next cell, and the yellow circles can diffuse into the adjacent cell as well, and the diffusivities of the two are dA and dB. So when these two processes are coupled, right, he derives an equation to explain beautiful patterns that are being formed in the nature. So assume that these are, say, two tanks which are connected to each other, and there is an unlimited source of A. It's continuously coming in, and at the same time there is an unlimited, like B is getting out at a certain rate. Okay, so the rate at which A comes in, let's call it F. F is the feed rate, and the rate at which B goes out could be called as K, that is the kill rate. And now when we talk about these two components A and B, which are being fed at certain rates and also are diffusing into the two adjacent cells and also reacting, so these two terms here, they are the diffusion terms, and these two terms are the reaction terms. So what's happening is two molecules of B combined with one molecule of A to give three molecules of B. So this is the rate of production of B is governed by AB squared. Similarly, rate of production of A depletes by AB squared. So this is one equation also formulated as Gray Scott model. You can read more about it. So let's see how we can put these equations in MATLAB and see how we can derive patterns. So you should observe here that dA by dt, that is A, is a function of both A and B, and dB by dt is again a function of both A and B. So this becomes a coupled ordinary differential equation, and we'll be solving these coupled ordinary differential equations. So Turing's reaction diffusion model also are known as Turing models, and they are explained using another chart, using activator inhibitor process as well. So here we have an activator which can auto-catalyze itself. Like the red region here is basically in the spatial environment, you can see how the concentration of red is, and in the spatial environment how concentration of the blue chemical is. So this is B is an inhibitor, and the red can produce itself as well as it can get converted into B. And if you see on the right hand side here, you have three graphs. These are snapshots at various times, time 1, time 2 and time 3. And you can see initially, let's assume that the concentration is quite random and we have some peaks of red at certain locations. And at a second snapshot, the peaks of red enhance themselves, firstly because they can autocatalyze, and also A can produce B, so in turn it can give shape to the peak of B as well, that is the blue curve. Similarly, we can see some very periodic patterns that will stabilize with time, and with time the patterns will no longer change, and but in space they give rise to very homogeneous different patterns, like say spots or stripes and so on. You can imagine that this position, if there was a z axis with multiple such positions, it could be something like a stripe basically. Any questions so far?
Yeah, it's okay, we can proceed, right? Do you have any questions?
Okay, so sure. I will now take you to how to set up these two equations that we saw, the Gray-Scott model in MATLAB, and then we'll see one, we'll put values for diffusivity of A, B, and some initial concentrations, and then we'll change these two parameters, basically the feed rate and the kill rate. We'll change these two parameters to see how just these two parameters, starting with the same initial condition of A and B, how it can lead to different patterns. So we'll do that in MATLAB. So I have here in the drop down menu a number of patterns, a number of values for F and K. I've specified the feed rate and kill rate, and we've specified some constant diffusion rates for this entire problem, and the grid here we are talking about is the mesh basically. So I'll just demonstrate this by first running one of the examples. I'm going to keep this point feed rate as 0.055 and kill rate as 0.062, and I'm going to run this entire code because it's better for me to explain what mesh is once the figure is complete. So can you see here there is some evolution of a particular shape? So what we saw was an initial concentration of A and B, and now with reaction and diffusion they are sort of spreading across the entire region. And when I'm talking about width 128, it's nothing but the pixels here. So the number of pixels in X direction and Y direction, there are about 128 by 128 pixels. That is the mesh that I'm talking about. So we'll meanwhile examine the MATLAB code while this is still running. It takes some time to run. And here we are specifying the time step, that is dt, that is 0.25 seconds, and we are specifying the stop time as 2000 seconds. Now to solve this equation, we need some initial conditions, right? So the initial conditions would be the concentrations of the two species, and also
are you still there? We lost you on the audio, it seems. It's a network issue, right? Hello, can you hear us? I think we lost you. Yeah, she's offline. It says it's connecting, right? So we had this discussion about team doing this on the 13th of Friday. So in a certain way it's like and then we are saying that no, scientists are not scared of any kind of, they don't have any kind of superstition. So it will just work out fine. But probably I will just communicate it to her and then probably I can take it forward.
you what they okay oh you were offline until now okay can you see my screen when did you lose me Changing the initial conditions, meaning we are changing the values of F and K to see what pattern we can see. Did you see the first pattern there? Okay, this is the second pattern. So let me show you another one where we are decreasing the value of F by a large extent and keeping the value of K almost the same. And let's observe what happens here. Ideally, all these patterns, like after a large amount of time, these patterns will stabilize in nature and they'll come to one steady state patterns. And with respect to time, they won't change, but with respect to space, they would have already organized, self-organized. So here we can see how some spots are taking shape.
So we say this is how a cheetah gets its spots.
Exactly. And what researchers have done over the past some years is by writing various models and increasing the complexity of it by say adding like here we have just two components right A and B which is not the case in the real system. We might have millions of components and they might have various reaction rates and various diffusivities and so on. By tuning these parameters researchers have actually proved Alan Turing's hypothesis of reaction diffusion. I'll show you the experimental proof in the slides. This is the evolution of spots basically. And there's one more I would like to show. So here we just we're playing around with the two numbers and we're starting with the same initial shape or initial pattern. We're starting with the same initial pattern but it will result in multiple different final patterns. So here you can see I'm going to change this FNK again. I'm going to run this. So we see we are starting with the same initial pattern and let's see what happens here. Here if you observe closely you can see something like mitosis that will happen. So there are two cells which are growing and then you can see that the cells can start splitting into each other, into two other cells.
I think we lost her again, right?
No, it's connected.
It's connected. Span, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, cool.
This is a bit slow, but we'll come up. Just give me a moment.
Okay, but yeah. So this is like we are solving these equations numerically. Yeah. That is a good question. So like we should be able to compare it against something, right?
Some validation
has. Yeah. So in our case we are just demonstrating how to work with this kind of equations, but like mathematicians have been able to work with this equation and validated it for a particular species of fish. So that you will find in one of the papers that she will be sharing. So experimentally it was validated, But yeah, analytically also, like, we have not tried to solve this equation analytically, we tried to do it numerically, but we have a symbolic computation toolbox using which you can actually do symbolic computation also. So there you can write equations as we write equations and then work with those equations to get analytical solutions.
If you run this same code in a HPC system which has much higher compute power, you can see that these cells will just keep multiplying until the entire space is uniformly filled. So this is, say, for example, like something like mitosis. We started from the same initial shape and then we ended up with forms which are spaced evenly at the end. That's what you will see here. So this is one demonstration of how we solve coupled differential equations, and we are trying to explain how using Turing's hypothesis of reaction diffusion, we are trying to explain how biological organisms take shape and stripes and so on. So let me get back to the point. So some trivia though, did any of you know that Alan Turing is actually connected with MATLAB? Like, there is some connection.
Anyone, you have heard about Alan Turing, the mathematician? Nice. So he actually, yeah, you have been. Yeah. That's correct. So we call it a programming environment because while you can write code here, that is good, but you can also do similar things using, we have particularly Simulink as a platform where you don't need to write code also. We have toolboxes also where you don't need to write always code, because we assume that we are not programmers primarily. Program is something that helps us carry out our task. We are maybe scientists, we are maybe engineers. So in case of us, we just focus on the problem that we are trying to solve. We are developing algorithm or doing any kind of processing. The code is getting automatically generated in many of the cases. So in MATLAB, if you do certain operations, you can generate the code by itself. You don't need to specifically write C code or let's say CUDA code or any other code. But for our programs, if you want to do conventional programming, we have a particular type of scripting that you need to know a bit. Yeah. Sure, Span. Please continue.
Okay, yeah. So Alan Turing and connection with MATLAB. So basically, Alan Turing, as you all must know, pioneered the Enigma machine and so on. And also a father of computer science to an extent, right? First computer designed by him. And most of the mathematical logic behind making of a computer was given by him. And his assistant, Mr. Jim Wilkinson, is... happens to be a person who has co-authored a very famous bunch of papers on eigenvalue problem solving. And these papers were all put into Fortran code by a person known as Cleve Moeller, who happens to be the founder of MATLAB in a way. He's also the first person who wrote the language MATLAB. And the entire MATLAB is basically Matrices, Matrix Laboratory, that is how it was called. Nowadays, it doesn't necessarily have a full form as such, but it was initially Matrix Laboratory, now it does much more than matrices. MATLAB, fundamental to MATLAB is Matrix, and Matrix, basically all linear algebra operations. Cleve Moeller had written all Fortran code. Easily, for students, he had made a package so that they didn't have to learn Fortran to use it, and that's how MATLAB came out from that particular language known as LINPACK and ISP and so on. So you can read more about it. There's a link over here, and we'll share it if you like. So now, getting back to the problem of reaction diffusion. So let me go back to what I was talking about, We were talking about how did researchers finally prove that reaction diffusion could be an explanation for why certain organisms take patterns and so on. The answer is yes. 50 years after Turing's hypothesis, a research group in Japan actually did prove it, and how they used zebra fish
models to study the initial pattern and the final pattern, and they simulated these models also. So you can see here initially something, a line of a bunch of dots became stripes, and using a mathematical, a particular mathematical model, the Japanese researchers could show that a line of dots can morph into stable stripes and also into different spots and so on. So this was the final experimental proof that reaction diffusion phenomena was a reason why organisms take spherical shapes. So I think my part here is complete. So we've given a demo of how to use MATLAB. You sort of know what MATLAB is, basically a high level programming language. You don't have to, you're already used to scripting on say C or Fortran or something. They are low level programming languages, so you will have to call in the right libraries and so on. So here we don't have to do that. We have a lot of tools and apps. For researchers specifically, I would like you to explore the apps section here. So if you have some data and you want to say fit a curve to that data, you can explore this curve fitting app, and also we have optimization app and so on. These are very, very useful for researchers. And in the curve fitting app, you can directly like choose the workspace variables, and then you can fit the fit curves or surfaces. And also, if you have written some code in MATLAB, you can package all this code nicely in an app yourself, and you can put it out for public use as well on MATLAB File Exchange or any other platforms like GitHub and so on.
So we have an app designer for this one. So you can take the code, put it in an app, and distribute among different users, potential users. So I'll just take it from here. So we have a couple more user stories in which we are not going to show the tool usage as such, but we are just going to talk about it. So one of them is how radio astronomy instruments have been developed in a very short time using Simulink libraries. So anybody from who is like working in the field of radio astronomy? Do we have someone?
Not here,
but there could be someone.
Now, of course, NCRA, they have the instrument called GeoMark. Mm-hmm. There are also some astronomers, but not so much working on
that. Okay. Okay, thank you, sir. So, typically, like objects in the universe emit waves in a wide electromagnetic spectrum. So if you just look at the sky like this, possibly if you are looking at it in a, using a, in the visual domain, you will just see something like this. But if you point and if you are able to get the radio waves from this kind of sources, you can probably see something like this. So specifically, radio waves allow us to get more information in a particular way about the physics of particular astronomical objects which emit radio waves. So typically, when you are looking with the spectrum of around 3 kilohertz to about 9 gigahertz is the wavelength at which you are able to detect these radio sources. So how do we normally do? So many of us are familiar with something like this. We have always, many of us have seen this, right? So these are particularly antennas that can gather these radio waves, and then once you have the radio waves, there is a particular amount, a particular processing that you need to do before you are able to get useful information from those radio signals, radio waves. So how do we do that? So typically, if there is any kind of signal processing workflow, this is something we do. First, we need to get to access the data. We have to find out how we can take this data in into our system, and then we should be able to pre-process this data, because it could be coming in from multiple sources at different times. There could be missing data also. So we should be able to clean this data and transform it in a way so that our algorithm can run run using this data. And then we can extract particular features of this data, and then we can use models and try to see how well it matches with our predictions, or we can also in some cases deploy these models also onto hardwares and try to see how it performs. So typically, if we look, we need domain specific expertise in the pre-processing and exploring data set. And also when you are deploying it, you need to be able to figure out how to put it on a particular hardware, because different hardware have different kind of requirements with respect to algorithms. So challenges in radio astronomy stem from two main factors. Firstly, real-time processing of data. How to do this, all this processing real-time, because each antenna element can produce a huge amount of data of the order of around 200 gigabytes per second. And then you need multiple array of antennas, because often the sources have very faint signals. So you combine all the signals and try to magnify them. And typically this kind of astronomical phenomena light lasts only a few milliseconds. So your window of opportunity is very small. So traditionally what used to happen was that there were domain specific expertise used to be needed. So there were engineers involved who actually developed this kind of real time instrumentation so that you can detect this kind of signals. So one possible solution to avoid this and try to come up with something new was tried out by the University of Berkeley. So they have a Center for Astronomy Signal Processing and Electronics. So what they want to do is that they want to build a common platform where all this processing and all this designing can be done, and it is both scalable. If your hardware changes, you can it does not matter, and it should also be able to be reused. A different group could be working on a similar hardware, and they need not start from scratch to develop all these things. So they wanted to actually bring this more rapidly. From design into implementation, this whole phase, they wanted to do it rapidly. So they needed a reusable modular platform for signal processing basically. But one thing that is important here, why this is possible, is that most of this kind of instruments actually have some common components. So if you're doing digital signal processing, for a particularly spectrometer, you will need some filters, some polybank filters, then you will need to do FFTs. Then you need to also have some kind of blocks for integration, transposition, buffers and all. So all of these things they developed using a particular, all these libraries they developed using Simulink. So in Simulink they had a library, modular library, where all these functions were put in, and that could be accessed by any user across the globe. And it is like platform independent. You can switch to a different platform. You don't need to change your designs and all. And as your hardware capabilities expand, you don't need to change anything in the design part. The code can be generated automatically. So typically, you have a library. So once, if a particular student wants to start working on it, they have some tutorials where you can go and learn how to build a particular design from the library. And then you simulate it. Once you have your design ready, either you put a wave generator in Simulink, take it and see how the output looks like, or you could have your some kind of data you can also generate. If you have some data, you can put it and you can get the simulated results. And once you are satisfied with what you get in terms of results, only then you go to the deployment phase. And the since any kind of the code can be deployed on different kind of platforms, so you don't need to worry about the deployment part. Even in case like multiple of these FPGAs use HDL code, hardware description code. So that code is automatically generated in Simulink. So you don't need to write or know that coding part. So that code gets automatically generated. So eventually if you use this kind of, we call it a workflow, it's an end-to-end workflow. So you can start from signal processing and then you can build the design from the libraries, you can simulate it, and then you can deploy it all on the same platform. You don't need to change platform. Everything can be done on Simulink. So that is what they have created in the University of Berkeley, and they have tested it on multiple systems. So FlyAsEye is something that was developed by, I think there was one postgraduate student and three undergraduate students. So typically this type of the signal processing part of this kind of systems need around 5 years to be developed. But what I've known is that they have done it in around 3 months. So you can say that you save a lot of time. if you follow this kind of process, this kind of workflows. And then it can, like very recently it has been deployed in China. It's a 500 meter aperture spherical telescope in which they use this platform, and it can detect extremely faint radio waves from an array of sources across the universe. So why is this important? Apart from time saving, it helps you to collaborate, because once you make something, other communities also are able to use it rather than reinventing the wheel. And then you can design and verify everything before deployment, because deployment is like you are deploying in some particular hardware. Before that, you can test everything. So this is one example I took from the astronomy. The other example I am taking is from the domain of material science and engineering. So we are now familiar in our lives with multiple devices where battery is involved, right? So it could be our mobile phones, starting to, it could be even vehicles that are coming up now in the market. Now, particularly in these applications, the major concern is safety, because incidents of fire have been reported till last year. So just if we look at the Federal Aviation Administration in the US, which looks after the aerospace domain, so they reported around 46 incidents in 2019 alone. So battery safety is very critical. Now, when traditionally we work with battery safety, the challenges are that finding that ideal battery material combination is very difficult. So traditionally, either people do a kind of modeling, so you try to do trial and error computation looking at different material choices, or you can also try to do it in an experimental way, and it takes up a lot of time. So a different approach was tried in Stanford University, where for the first time they tried to use AI to find out which are the optimal choices for candidates for these batteries, lithium batteries. So specifically, how would you approach if you want to use AI in a particular domain, let's say? Anybody working with AI in the AI domain? No?
Machine learning, etc., for picking up some signals which are very rare.
So signal processing is quite common in the signal processing community, that's correct.
The accelerator physics group people do employ some of these tools, also the neural networks and so on and so forth, which were a little predecessor.
Correct.
But not in the domain that probably you want to say.
Okay, sure. So initially, you start with some data. You need some database already. So once you have a data, it could be experimental data, it could be data from simulation. You actually go and try to label and pre-process this data so that you can come up with a predictive model. So there are different models that can be generated based on this data. So traditionally, how we are used in our computer program, we take in data and then we come up with a result. In this case, you put in data and you come out with the model, and that model then can be used for making different predictions, and that model either you can use it to get your results, or you can make apps out of it, or you can put it in particular hardwares, you can share with different people. I already have like one app in my mobile which I developed using machine learning, which tracks whether I'm walking, whether I'm sitting. So all these things can be done in the same platform. So this is the typical artificial intelligence workflow, that's what we say. So how did these researchers attempt to use this workflow? So first they started with a database where they had around 12,000 probable candidates which could provide some kind of good ionic conductivity. And then actually they started to select which features are important for getting the good performance out of it. So they came up with 20 features depending upon the local atomic arrangement and chemistry of the crystals. And then they tried to find out, they came up with a model that actually fits this kind of, that takes in these features and tries to give you a very good model. And that classification model they eventually used to get their results. So you can get the results or you can publish in the last step. So what they found was that if you follow this kind of approach, you actually come up with very good candidates. So here they came up with around these dark spots actually represent the probable good candidates. So they came up with eventually 5-6 good candidates, which were also chemically stable, which were having good ionic conductivity, low electronic conductivity, and all those features. And this they came up from that eventually that big database of around 12,000 candidates. So eventually, if you look at this graph, they have plotted the probability of observation, and on the x-axis they have predicted ionic conductivity. So if you go to the right hand side, the ionic conductivity keeps increasing. So if you see, ML guided technique is the machine learned guided technique, the AI technique. Actually, they gave the probability of higher probability of observation of good conductivity if you go towards this range. And if you are using any kind of random technique, then probably you can get some good candidates, but they will have lesser conductivity. So eventually they have also said that they have used MATLAB extensively for the data analysis and from structuring the files, extracting the features, the entire workflow. So this is what the student had to say, and they actually compared it with the different techniques that we conventionally use. So here they have predictions per second on the log scale, and on the other scone they have put a score to it. So a higher score means a better idea of that you are getting a very good kind of you are getting quite good conductivities, good accuracy, sorry. So if you see, if normal PhD students were working, 6 PhD students were working in the lab on similar problems, identification of good candidates for higher ionic conductivity, and their score was on the lower end. Density functional theory gives you very good F1 score because it can accurately predict what the eventual performance is going to be like, but it takes a long time. So predictions per second is very low. On the other hand, the machine learning example that we have, where we had an AI workflow, it was trained on 40 examples and its prediction per second was, its F1 score was quite reasonable and the predictions per second were quite fast. So that eventually they were able to come up with possible candidates in a much faster time using this workflow. So these were the two user stories that I had. Any questions you have so far?
Yeah. MATLAB as the main.
Correct. Yeah. So typically what we do is that if you are interested in this kind of workflow, yes?
In the simulink, you have shown, mm-hmm. does all the models in the simulink are synthesizable to hardware description language?
Synthesizable to?
Means hardware description language. You told me it can be converted to HDL. So whether all the blocks in the simulink that you have shown is irrespective of the platform FPGA, can be
there are specific blocks actually for HDL. We, as of now, there are very specific blocks that are used to make this kind of models where you can generate the HDL code directly. That is correct. What you're saying is very correct.
It's specific to the target.
Exactly. It's not specific to the target. Yes, Dhruv. Sorry, I heard something. So no, it's very specific blocks that actually generate the HDL code, which you can use for making this kind of models. Yeah. Yeah, correct. So specifically what our team does is that if you are working in a particular area and if you are willing to explore, if you want to know about how to use, let's say, machine learning in your research or how to use deep learning in your research. So for that, we can do specialized workshops also. Or if you are working in a very specialized area where you need some help from us, we can do WebEx sessions like what we did with Spandana. So any of our experts around the globe can join in and can help you with your work. So that can be arranged. So as of now, I will just share some resources with you, because like now you are in a campus-wide license that your institute has purchased. So if you go and if you want to access MATLAB, this is the page where you will find all the information required. So this is the link that is there. We call it the portal. So you have a portal where you will know how to access the different, the software, the different tools. You also have some functionalities where already some trainings are there, so basics you can learn from here. And then what are the features of this campus-wide license? So you can have collaborative research. If different research groups are working and if each of them is using the same tool, you can do collaborative research. Like I am from an interdisciplinary background and I work with people from the mechanical domain, chemical domain. It's very easy if I'm building a model for them to also work on the same model. And it's just not collaboration. Also, if you have any visiting researcher to your institute, or if you are working with a particular person who doesn't have MATLAB, in this case, you can actually have a third party access as a format for the collaborative research. So you can allow the other person who is coming in to get a access to MATLAB and Simulink. So all you need is the email ID. Specifically for you, all you need to do is that you need to go to the MathWorks page and use your institute email ID to create your own profile. And then campus-wide license means unrestricted access to all our toolboxes, all our features on any number of devices. So you can install it on your laptops, take it anywhere. You can install it on your mobiles, because nowadays your mobile also acts as a computation tool. There are sensors in your mobile which you can use to prepare different kind of apps. So you can install it in your mobile on n number of devices and you can use it as an access off campus also. So how are we positioned here? So many of the research that happens starts at the basic level in academic, in research institutes. And then you have accelerator and startup programs where you commercialize that IP. And eventually it goes into the industry, where the industry uses these ideas and then comes up with products and services. So as the demand for those products and services grow, they require manpower, which mostly comes from undergraduates or postgraduates from university. So, and then they are also, when they learn how to use our tools, when they go to the research, to do advanced research, they can directly fit into this. So as MATLAB is like directly we fit into this ecosystem very well. We collaborate with academia, we collaborate with institutions, academic institutions, research institutions. So we work with all of them. Also nowadays it's very important that you are not just able to make your work, make your own work successful, but you need to be able to share your code. So there is an ability, there is a source control. So you can upload your code on Git, you can upload your code on MATLAB Central that we have, and that can be directly shared. So you can track which version of code you have using this Git. And then you can also make apps out of it. You can also make some certain toolboxes and then you can pass it on to the end users. So you can directly work with GitHub. Also we have IoT nowadays. So if you are doing some kind of computation where you need to have a real-time analysis, so that analysis can be run on our cloud platforming platform known as IoT. And then it's just not MATLAB. If you're working with some other code, it could be Python, it could be Fortran or other code. So you can call those codes into MATLAB, work with our tools, and then you can also export those codes into other formats. So that is there also. So I would be interested very much to know what you are planning to use MATLAB for and how we can help you better. Thank you. Any questions you have?
Okay, so yes, simulations, what you showed about, especially about that second example which you showed.
For astronomy?
That,
for the first one. Reaction diffusion.
So, in that, those things, you use MATLAB exclusively or you have coupled it with some other software also?
Now, as of now, we used it totally on MATLAB. We have done the coding part totally on MATLAB. Oh, user experiences, they were both on MATLAB, but that I had not done. So those were user stories from our users.
Because many times so that like a console or something that is used with MATLAB coupling. So in that lot of simulations you can do what you showed. So but this was done that fashion or exclusively on MATLAB? Any idea?
So second one was exclusively on the MATLAB, but the Casper project, I think it's like an open source platform. So you have different libraries there also. But these are all built upon Simulink, I think.
But to use Simulink, you should have MATLAB also.
So yeah, so Simulink is built on top of MATLAB.
That's what first he showed
us. Yeah. So it's a, like typically why that thing came, I can give you an idea. Like automotive sector explicitly uses our tools, so they need they need not invent and write code from scratch. There are existing modules, they can take it, combine it, and then complete that entire model in just one platform. And then they pass it with the within the different groups. So there could be electrical groups working, there could be mechanical groups working. So they pass the code from one group to the other before it goes to deployment. That was the user's database. So they had a database for the all the lithium, I think, that was there, already there. So when you start working with AI, the first thing that is very important is that you need to have some data. So otherwise, you can't start, you can't use this workflow. If you have less data, then probably machine learning is a good option. If you have lots and lots of data, then people use deep learning. More accurate. No, DFT is not there. No. But I would be interested in in the first slide, you have my email ID. Probably I will share my slide also, and then you can get back to me and let me know if there is any topic that would help your students, so we can come up and plan a workshop along those lines.
Specifically.
Yeah. So typically our team does one day workshops. So one day we do from 9 to 5. So if it is more than one day, we also have a training group in MathWorks. So that is paid. But they will give you training for 3-4 days on a very specific area. It could be digital signal processing and then generating HDL code. So they do very specific things. But if you are okay with a one-day workshop where we cover the basics and then later on we can do something, we can go to a more advanced level, then that our team does. So we are a team of around 10 people now. So we are also expanding. And our team, each one of us has very different experiences. Somebody has an electronics background, somebody has mechanical. I have interdisciplinary. Spandana has chemical background. So we have people from various different backgrounds. So we try to do the workshop if our presence is needed. Otherwise, if you need experts, so for that we will be doing WebEx sessions like we did in the beginning.
Till now you have discussed about only software aspect of the deadline.
Correct. So for particular some hardwares, once you develop the code either on MATLAB or in Simulink, there's a button called deployment. So if you know which hardware platform it is, you can directly deploy it on the hardware and do real-time testing also. So that the software takes care of.
That's something linked to what I was asking, but I thought you said some selective, particular modules.
So that's for HDL. So that's for the HDL library.
Okay.
So if I'm using, let's say I have, I also use those things, Arduino. Let's say I have an Arduino board or a Raspberry board. So there, any of the Simulink blocks I can use, design everything, and I can test it. But for these Arduino and Raspberry, there are specific libraries that I have to get. We have an add-on button there at the very top. Using the add-on button, you just need to install those libraries, and then it will help you deploy the code directly there.
But with the institute license, whether you allow that?
Everything is allowed. It is there.
All open source,
Everything is there.
But this one is anyway, you have license.
So yeah.
But I'm not sure if his question was
properly answered. I don't know. If you are talking about HDL, there are specific blocks that are...
No.
Yeah.
For example, in the FPGA, there are Xilinx FPGA.
Correct.
So if you name one Simulink block, one Simulink development, whether that development can be deployed in Altera and...
Any target or specific target?
Specific target.
No, target can be any. So either either the HDL code is generated, or if there is particular some hardware, directly the code is generated. So you don't need to worry about going to HDL and then. So what I can do is that I can put you in touch, there is one person in our team who specializes in this area alone.
Hmm.
So he can actually help you with if you are working with particular targeted hardwares. So that information I can pass you with. So I can connect you with people. So that's what it is. Like if anybody is working in the renewable energy domain, so there my expertise come in which domain I have worked. And there I can tell you how to use our tools to model. But if it's something very specific, then I can connect you with the proper resource person.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of people from our institute who are in your area of specialization. They're not here.
Okay, so but I would happy to come back. I know this was like a very odd day because given the corona virus and then given it's Friday the 13th. So, yeah.
So, what is the typically the minimum data required to get started the artificial intelligence process?
That is a very interesting question. So, what we typically see, the more the data, the better. But if you have less data, there are some workarounds. Like if you are able to simulate and get some results, it's good. Or in some cases, if you have less data, there is something called, I think it's called GAN or something. So that actually helps you generate more data. There are like, if you're working with images, there are particular operations you can do with the images. You can transpose them, you can flip them, and then you can generate more data. So there are a couple of workarounds that you have if you don't have a lot of data.
But for many general problems, which are in the industry or social domain, entertainment domain, and so on, there are many databases that they exist, and they are open source. So, pattern recognition problems, etc.
Speech but, and all.
Speech and so on. Even video. But, I mean, there is something very...
I am very specific.
So, that...
So, can you tell what data you have, so that I can get an idea of...
So, I will discuss.
Yeah, that is great then, sir. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, so what they will be saying is, okay, this is some kind of heads up thing, because we obviously cannot cover everything about MATLAB, but people here or maybe those who couldn't attend, because you are talking about, you know, power, energy related thing, there are a couple of people, we will try to pass on this thing to them and maybe you can connect them up.
Sure.
Also for the one-day courses, one-day workshops or even the specialized workshop, probably that is something only a group, small group of specialists probably will be interested.
That is fine.
We'll also connect up.
Like even for workshops, we typically don't do more than 40 people because you can't do hands-on workshop with a huge crowd.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that's very nice and thanks, Dave.
Thank you all for coming.